This episode contains graphic descriptions of crime scenes, which may be disturbing to some listeners.
Today we're bringing you part two of the murder of Holly Brannigan, a teenager who's home alone, talking on the phone. By all appearances, it's just another typical day in a suburban neighborhood. But danger is looming in more ways than one. And it starts when Holly hears a knock. Someone's at the door.
This is APB Cold Case. Here's your host, former police chief Mark Spahn.
In part one, we learned that 17-year-old Holly Brannigan was home alone, talking on the phone, when the call was interrupted by a knock at the door. The next day, her body was found lying on the kitchen floor with a knife in her back. That same day, her good friend Sally was picked up at school by police and questioned for hours. The investigation is just getting started. If you haven't already done so, go back and listen to part one. So now, let's pick up where we left off. Holly Brannigan used to babysit for the Dowdle boys, Kurt and Eric, who lived down the street. Here's Eric.
Holly was our babysitter. My family became quite a connoisseur of babysitters because my brother and I were hellions. And so we went through them pretty fast. Some stayed, some didn't. Some came back, some ran for the hills. Holly was with us for a period of time, and that's how I met her. We knew where she lived. I'd been to her house.
I asked Eric about the Brannigan's house.
With regard to that house, the Brannigan home stood out in our neighborhood because of not only its placement, it stood high on a, being overly dramatic, it stood up on a hill, and it was a very modern architectural style. It's really striking home. The deck that surrounded the living areas was cantilevered out over the entry. So it was almost creating a portico or an overhang for parking.
He remembers the day Holly's body was found.
My brother and I were walking home from the bus stop. You know, in 1979, we were both going to school at Hanover Elementary School. And we were walking home from the bus stop. And I recall seeing the yellow caution tape at the end of the road, at the end of the Brannigan driveway. And to say that we had grown up in a very naive, idyllic sort of place, I think it's a fair statement. Caution tape was not something I had ever seen before. And it was, clearly it was a nice March afternoon. It was the end of March. The weather was getting warm. It was spring. There's rebirth. And then the yellow, bright yellow caution tape stood out in stark contrast to the buds and the green. I don't know what to say other than to say it was jarring. And then after that, we started talking and we started trying to figure out what was going on. And I remember going to sleep, in the early parts of that summer when with the windows open, hearing people walking around up in the woods behind our house, seeing flashlights and things like that. So to say that, you know, it was essentially a turn for the surreal because we saw something that didn't belong. And after that, everything kind of changed a little bit.
Not only did Holly's murder become etched in the minds of the neighborhood kids, it's still there. 45 years later, it shocked the whole community. And the fact that Holly, the nice young girl, the babysitter who used to protect and watch over Eric and his little brother Kurt had been killed, and that no one was there to protect her when she needed it, made it apparent that their little corner of the world was no longer the safe place it once had been.
A part of our childhood ended because someone we knew died. And it's not just that someone died, it's that someone was ripped from this earth in a very violent and horrible way. You know, it was just as jarring, I imagine, for almost everybody else in the neighborhood as it was for us. And so people just started talking about it. The next contact, you know, as we talked about it and talked about it and talked about it, you know, I remember going into seventh grade and we talked about it still. And my God, here we are, you know, what, 45 years later? It's 1979, 45 years later, we're talking about it still. Our journey in our neighborhood has been 45 years long, not just 4 days. And it was the end of innocence. Not in so many thundering terms, but it was a visitation of horrible things from outside our neighborhood into our neighborhood that didn't really belong there, but yet there they were. And it was a neighborhood where doors were left unlocked and where kids came home after school and let themselves into houses because parents were working. And from that point on, you know, our mindset changed. I remember my brother and I, and I remember myself particularly, going door to door with a coffee can with Holly's picture on it, trying to get donations for the reward fund. My dad started the reward fund. He was involved in local matters.
An article from the March 23, 2014 edition of the Morning Call newspaper in Allentown said, quote, "Groups of adults, students, and Boy Scouts knocked on doors to hand out flyers and collect donations," end quote. Holly's classmates also put on a benefit talent show and sold nearly 900 tickets to help boost the amount of the reward.
In 1979, they raised something like $6,000 for, you know, information leading to the arrest and prosecution. But I remember doing that when I was a kid. I was just a kid.
Eric Dowdle has not forgotten about the tragedy of 1979, and he never will. His memory of the neighborhood is a curious hybrid of peace and beauty, marred by the murder of a girl in her own home, a home that he'd once visited and can still picture today.
The kitchen where Holly was found was off the deck on the right-hand side of the, I'm imagining as I'm talking about it, it was off the deck on the right-hand side of the home as you faced it. And so, you know, really and truly, whoever did it, and I, you know, I have my own ideas, but whoever did it knew the neighborhood, knew the location, and didn't stand out in any way. There were two ways to approach the home. One was up a steep winding street and up into the driveway of the Brannigan home. If that's the case, then it had to be a car or a type of car that didn't seem out of place in the neighborhood because it was obviously happened during the daylight hours and there were always people around, or somebody came through the backwoods. And it was a wooded lot. There were woods that we knew every inch of when we were little kids, because that's, you know, where we played. That's where the forts were. That's it, it bordered an apple orchard. You know, the reality of it is, you know, it had to be someone who was familiar with the neighborhood, who knew the neighborhood, who was familiar with the woods, possibly, or did not stick out. There's a story that I read when I was younger, a short story called The Invisible Man. And it wasn't the science fiction horror story, The Invisible Man, but quite opposite. It was about a murder that was carried out by a person posing as a mailman, because we become so used to people who belong in a neighborhood that they become invisible. We don't even see them moving around. And so I submit to you that really what had to have happened was it was someone who looked like they belonged in the neighborhood, or it was someone who came up through the back through the woods, which equally plausible. But, you know, we don't know.
Was the murderer hiding in plain sight? If so, the killer's identity remained hidden because the canvas conducted by police at the time didn't turn up any solid leads. The investigation continued on as they waited for the autopsy. According to an AP article published in the Indiana Gazette, the autopsy showed that there were, quote, 15 serious knife wounds, 3 slight wounds, and 2 defensive wounds of the hands apparently received while trying to ward off the knife blows, end quote. There had been some speculation at the time that Holly may have been pregnant, but the autopsy quickly quashed that rumor. When her body was found, she was fully clothed in jeans and a shirt. One published report says that there were no fingerprints on the murder weapon, a knife that came from inside the Brannigan's own home. So, no indication that Holly had been sexually assaulted, and no robbery. Except for the kitchen, the house appeared to be in order. Again, here's retired Bethlehem police officer Craig Stefko. You'll remember he was one of the first officers to arrive on the scene.
I don't believe anything in the house. I believe some things on the kitchen, like stuff on the maybe refrigerator or stove might have been disturbed. I don't recall, you know, like a towel knocked down or some of the magnets disturbed. I'm not really, nothing like chairs tipped over or things ransacked or gone through, no.
So let's talk about the people that detectives have already questioned. Holly's brother, Sean. Of course, they questioned him first. He found the body. His demeanor was a little strange. Here's Craig Stefko.
Of course, we felt really weird when he came up and said, "That's her," really cold. We're thinking, oh, man.
But Sean had an alibi. He said he was with his friend all night. Police would have to confirm his story. We did ask Holly's friend Sally about Holly's relationship with her brother.
Typical brother-sister. They were close, and then they weren't, and then they were close, and they weren't. So, like, when the mom passed away, they got close. They had each other. They needed each other. And then they got into high school, and even though she was no younger than she was before, it's like, oh, you don't get this. You're, you know, we're in ninth grade, he's in 10th. And, you know, it seemed like years away. But, I mean, it was the typical brother-sister, nothing crazy.
And as we know, Sally was also questioned by police.
If I could go back in time, I wish I had a backbone enough to say something to them. Because again, once they got me in there and they said, you realize Holly's dead. And then they said something within the next three sentences. I can't quote at this point. It's been too many years. But it was, do you realize how many fingerprints of yours are all over that house? And I'm thinking, yeah, I do know that, but I didn't do this. How dare you? Like, here I am upset, and I still felt like I was being accused. I don't know the exact wording, but I do know that at the time, I was now fearful that I was going down for something that I didn't do.
Of course, Sally was cleared. Detectives would go on to question many others. Holly's father, other friends, her classmates, the members of the soccer team she managed, including coaches and referees. They needed to find out what was going on in her life. Was she being stalked? Did she have problems with a boyfriend, or maybe someone she was seeing? Was someone infatuated with her? There's a lot we don't know, but let's recap the timeline. On March 28, 1979, at 2:30 p.m., Holly gets home from school. Around 4:30 p.m., Holly's on the phone with a friend when she hears someone knocking at the door. She tells the friend to hold on. A couple minutes later, she picks up the downstairs extension and tells the friend, I have to go. I'll call you back. 4:45 p.m., an employee from Richard Branigan's office tells police that Holly called, asking if her dad had already left for his conference in Atlantic City. The employee says yes. Now, when police enter Branigan's house the next day, the upstairs phone is sitting on Holly's bed, and the handset's off the hook. So how could Holly have called her dad's office, presumably from the downstairs phone at 4:45 p.m., if the phone was off the hook upstairs? We could offer up several scenarios, but it would be speculation. So let's move on. At 5 p.m., Sean calls the house to speak with Holly, but he gets a busy signal. At 11 p.m., Sean calls again, but the line is still busy. And that brings us to Thursday, March 29, 1979. Around 7:30 a.m., Holly's friend Sally stops by the house to pick her up for school. She honks the horn, eventually getting out of the car and ringing the bell. But Holly never appears, and Sally leaves. At 10:40 a.m., Sean and his friend enter the house, where they find Holly dead on the kitchen floor. Was Holly's killer the unknown person who knocked on the door at 4:30 p.m. the day before? And did she know them? It seems quite plausible. Also plausible that she was comfortable enough to let them into her home. After all, there was no sign of forced entry, no robbery, no sexual assault. But why were they in the kitchen? Holly's friend Sally thinks she knows why.
I am more under the belief that it was somebody that she had to have known, because again, in that day, the first thing you do is bring somebody up and you say, would you like something to drink or eat? And you sit around the kitchen table and chat. If you went to see Holly, that was the place she took you first. Let's go get a glass of water or lemonade or something, and, you know, we'll go from there. What do you want to do next? Watch TV or whatever. But it started in the kitchen. From what I've been told and from the scene and everything that's been put on TV, I'm thinking that it was somebody that she was familiar with, that she was playing hostess.
So what happened? Or better said, who happened? How long was the killer in the house? Was Holly still alive when Sean called at 5 p.m.? If the killer was someone she knew, what was the motive? Was there a confrontation that escalated? Was Holly resisting the advances of someone she knew? Remember, she was stabbed 18 times. What could unleash that level of rage? And don't forget, the knife came from within the home. So if someone went there with the purpose of killing her, wouldn't they bring their own weapon? Here's Craig Stefko.
I guess the theory was whoever did it grabbed it from behind, you get all the stab marks from the front. So if it was a large or male would have been able to overpower, could have very easily, you know, just had his arm around her upper shoulders and neck overpowered her and just kept stabbing her.
I guess I could just explain it the way it was explained to me. It seemed more like a crime of passion because of the intensity and the brutality of 18 stab wounds. Like someone was angry at her or upset or didn't get their way with her or something. That's the best way I can explain it. You know, it's, you know, if you're going to come into my house, you know, and there's an argument and you shoot me, you run, it's one thing, but if you shoot me 5, 6, 7, 8 times, now you're pretty mad at me. So that's, you know, apparently, yeah, that was the theory. That was just an act of passion.
We have no documentation confirming who was and who was not interviewed by police, but as the investigation progressed, detectives eliminated both Holly's brother and father from suspicion. And then, just 6 months after Holly's murder, another tragedy befell the Brannigan family. According to the Allentown Morning Call newspaper, it was on September 9th when Sean Brannigan and his friend Mark Viola were cleaning the floor at the service station where Sean worked. A spark ignited gas fumes, and both Sean and Mark were hurt. Mark's injuries were relatively minor, but Sean sustained third-degree burns over 80% of his body and smoke inhalation. Sean died about 1 week later. Could his death somehow be connected to Holly's? Many people think so. Even Holly's own father believed it. Shortly after Holly's murder, Sean reportedly told his dad he was going to spread the word that he knew who murdered his sister in order to flush out the killer. Here's Craig Stefko.
I did hear an interesting thing from a guy from the Cold Case Foundation, who's actually from Bethlehem, that he doesn't doubt that maybe the brother might have been murdered because the theory is they thought Holly might have been pregnant because she was sexually active. Apparently, somebody felt that maybe he was going to confront the father or because she was dating the one son or whatever, and that when he was set up in the gas station cleaning it when the explosion happened. So I don't know. That's just a theory. It could be, you know, hogwash.
We asked Sally about Sean's death.
The story was told to me that he put it out that he knew who did it. And that doesn't sound like something Sean would do, but because he's smarter than that. But maybe he did just because he wanted to solve the whole thing. But he went to Lehigh University. He was a highly intelligent individual. And he had worked at gas stations for at least 2 years, maybe longer. He knew the right process to do everything. So the fact that this, and maybe it was a faulty machine, but I still think he was too smart. I think somebody had to fly by and close those garage doors and cause the spark. He would not have done that with the garage doors closed. He, like I said, he's done it before. He's done that process before. And if you look at some of the pictures, it shows the garage doors down, which is why I say somebody flew by, closed those doors, and it doesn't take long. So that's my logic. I'm going to live with that. That's what I have to believe because I knew him. He was too smart to do a mistake like that. I think something was done. I don't know everything, but that's what's in my gut.
It's actually defining the word tragedy. It is tragedy in its deepest sense. Holly was killed in March, and then Sean died over the summer.
That's Eric Dowdle. I asked him what he thought about the circumstances of Sean's accident.
Rumor and speculation, sure. I mean, you know, the thing is, there's so much of that in this case, the rumor and speculation, but also the silencing and you know, in the deeper waters of our society, there are things that move well under the surface that if you're attuned to them or you see them come up for any kind of error, you sometimes wonder how much they have to do with anything. And I'm not trying to be obtuse. The reality is that there are powers and people that move and kind of push things in one direction or the other. And the question is whether this whole thing with Holly and Sean was, you know, there was a lot bigger forces at play there. Again, as I said, there was an awful lot of money, awful lot of power, there's an awful lot of prestige, and there were an awful lot of people who had access to those things that were in and around where this happened. and you'll never know. We had heard that Mr. Brannigan had told people that Sean was very afraid for himself. I can tell you that one of the kids in our neighborhood, after Holly was killed, we found a marijuana grow spot. Now, this was not, a field. This was a small grow spot. But nonetheless, there was a lot of paraphernalia and that kind of thing. And we reported to the police and such. But shortly thereafter, we were walking home from school, and a car tried to run down one of the kids that was in our group on the way home from school. And he had to run and hide under some bushes. Now, we never saw that car again. But the fact is that that did happen. So there was weird things like that. So it breeds that kind of speculation. The fact that the case has gone on so long breeds that kind of speculation. The fact that there's no clear answer and there's so many dead ends and odd things that are going on, it breeds that. So to say that that Sean's death was totally vanilla, I wouldn't say that, if you could ever say that about a death, but it clearly was not. There's a lot of it that doesn't make sense.
We may never know the absolute truth about Sean's death, but many people still have hope for a resolution in Holly's case. Like Eric said, there's been much speculation and rumor surrounding the deaths of both Holly and Sean Brannigan. So let's take a look at some of those theories. I think we can pretty much rule out the theory of robbery. The house was not ransacked, and nothing was reported missing. And the theory of a random intruder is possible, but doesn't seem probable. There are no similar crimes in the neighborhood. And with Holly's friend saying she heard a radio playing inside, and Officer Stefko saying a TV was turned on in the kitchen, would lend to the appearance that someone would be inside, making this a higher risk for a burglar. And there was no evidence of a forced entry, or the home being rifled, or that anything was disturbed beyond the kitchen. So, was her murder related to a boyfriend or some other relationship? Did Holly keep a journal? And if she did, would it hold a clue to who killed her? In terms of relationships, Holly's friend Sally doesn't remember her specifically having a boyfriend.
But again, maybe because Holly and I did have different classes, and even though we saw each other and were friends, we weren't as tight. Like, it's, when you're younger, you were really tight. You knew everything, every breath they took and everything they did at 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock. Once you got to high school, we were also bombarded with, all these extracurriculars and, I'll meet this friend here. And so I don't know. I can't piece this story together to make sense to me.
I asked Eric Dowdle if he thought Holly had a boyfriend.
I believe she did. Again, if you're asking me if I know from when I was a little kid, or if I know subsequently, when I was a little kid, I had no idea. I mean, as a 12-year-old or younger, you are me-centric. So I really didn't pay much attention to what was going on around me unless it affected me, which unfortunately is the way kids are. But, what I've learned later, I learned everything, everything everybody else has learned. We all have theories, and there are competing theories. There is one theory of an individual who was involved, who is now dead. But we're still trying to get to a place where everybody's comfortable to say it was or it wasn't him.
So was there a boyfriend or an acquaintance of Holly that police were looking into? If authorities did have a particular person of interest or a suspect early on, they weren't talking about it, but the investigation continued on. According to the Indiana Gazette in 1981, a couple years after the murder, a prison inmate named Michael Jezik told police he knew who Holly's murderer was, a 31-year-old petty thief and drug dealer. The informer said he was present when Holly was killed in a secluded area of the woods near her home. The article goes on to say that police were unable to corroborate the man's story, but from what we know about the crime scene, that supposed confession doesn't match up with the facts. As leads dwindled and without enough evidence to positively identify a killer, the case goes cold. According to the Gettysburg Times, in 1986, a suspect profile was created by the FBI's Behavioral Sciences Unit. It does not appear that any part of that report was ever publicly released, but is it leading investigators toward a particular person? In 2009, Northampton District Attorney John Morganelli told the Huntington Daily News that the investigation into Holly's murder had been reopened and that he was impressed at the work that had been done. He expressed hope that with advancements in DNA science, something not available during the time when Holly was killed, maybe that could help bring an answer. And then, in February 2010, Morganelli impaneled a grand jury to review the case. According to Lehigh Valley Live, more than 35 witnesses testified. In the end, they were able to eliminate suspects, but said there was not enough evidence to result in an arrest. And then, on March 23, 2014, Bethlehem police announced they've identified a suspect. Was this the same suspect that retired Bethlehem police officer Stefko mentioned earlier?
To be honest with you, the suspect, I don't even know how big he is. You know, as much as I know the name, I don't recall what he looks like if I ever saw him. I'm just familiar with the name and the family.
According to a story by news station WPVI in 2019, DA Morganelli said that even with DNA testing on the evidence that remained, and with at least one subject referred to as a person of interest, they were unable to make an arrest. The name of the suspect or person of interest has not been publicly released, though it seems to be known by those who are or have been close to the case throughout the years. In March of 2024, Jim Friedman, a photojournalist for Philadelphia's NBC 10 station, released a feature story on Holly's case. We have a link in our show notes. Here's Holly's friend, Sally.
I think Jim has like a suspect in his head, but I can't tie any kind of motive or thought process to it. I have never known who did it. I didn't even have an inkling. It wasn't until grand jury and sitting down again with like Jim Friedman that things were mentioned that started telling me that they were thinking down an avenue. It's so foreign to me, I can't even say, yeah, I can see how that could be. I have no clue that that would have worked that way.
Eric Dowdle also spoke with Jim Friedman.
What's funny with Jim Friedman is he called me out of the blue during COVID, and he told me who he was. And I said, you know, I've been waiting 40 years for somebody to call me and ask me these questions. And that's the honest truth. Because, you know, I've been singing the same story to anybody who will listen as long as I can remember. And for the first time, somebody called me to ask me about it. And, you know, this is a gentleman who grew up in Bethlehem who I didn't know before. And we've gotten to become good friends. And I really enjoy his time and his insight into this. And it's really been very helpful. So, again, there are a lot of things that we're still working on. And the amateur sleuths are still out there. But the real detectives are also working on it as well. I want nothing but the best for them, and hopefully we can give Holly some rest.
I asked Eric if the murder of Holly Brannigan had any influence on his choice of profession. You see, Eric is the first assistant district attorney in Lehigh County, Pennsylvania.
I can tell you that, do I think it influenced it? Maybe. Probably. The need to solve the problem, the need to solve the puzzle.
I asked Eric about the impact of Holly's murder on his brother, Kurt.
It's still very much alive for him. In fact, in some ways, more alive for him than it is for me. And for my brother, he has really dug deep, far deeper than I did. And we've been commiserating on a lot of things and talking about a lot of things. And I'm anxious to see where everything goes with the case.
In 2024, Kurt Dowdle released an interesting memoir called Dream Monster. I learned about the book after my interview with Eric Dowdle. Kurt wrote about growing up on Pine Top Trail in Bethlehem, how Holly's murder shook the neighborhood, and he shared his theory of who the killer is, described by some as shocking. I was curious if Sally had read the book.
Yes, Jim Friedman called me and told me I needed to buy it. I'm not sure I absorbed all of it. And then my husband read it. He was in high school with us, and he knew Holly as well. And so he read it and didn't know what to say. My sister read it, and she said, oh, my gosh, on Pine Top Trail, a family lived like that? That couldn't believe it. Like, we didn't believe that kind of dysfunction, that level of dysfunction. We know it's everywhere, but that level of dysfunction was out there. My brother, on the other hand, read it and said, that makes perfect sense. I believe that that's who did the murder. I'm like, Holly never talked about the Dowdle family to me that much, except that she was babysitting.
We asked Eric about his brother's memoir. He said that he's read it several times, and that his brother's comments are theories. We won't spoil it for you, but as I said before, the theory advanced by Kurt is shocking to a lot of people. His brother Eric said he will not comment on the validity of the book. Holly's dad, Richard, passed away in March 2016 without ever knowing who murdered his daughter. Holly's friend Sally attended his funeral.
He was like a second father to me, so I went to his funeral, and it amazed me. It was the right thing to do, but apparently he had life number one and life number two, because not one thing in the bulletin or in the service talked about Holly and Sean or that era. But it was kind of rough for me. Luckily, I saw some of my old neighbors, and so I'm sure he did change a little bit for the new wife and the losing his old life.
Holly's immediate family is all gone now, but Sally still wants justice for her friend.
You're getting me to tear up. Oh my gosh, I would be so thankful. I need to understand this. I don't like walking around not knowing. I mean, yes, I do believe that probably the person that did this is gone, could be passed away. But it's still fear of the unknown, fear of the unsolved, fear of the any of those words that you want to use. It just keeps looming over. And I also feel that if we could solve the Holly side of life, we could solve the Sean side, because I still believe that that's okay. His death, I don't believe, was an accident. I never have. And I'm thinking that if we get the Holly side solved, maybe someone could prove to me once and for all that Sean was an accident or not an accident. I would like that question answered as well.
Sometimes the passage of time is a way of distorting our perceptions. The Three Mile Island disaster wasn't the beginning of the end of the world that some thought it was back then. But the murder of Holly Brannigan is still as real and tragic today as it was in 1979. Eric Dowdle, the now grown-up little boy who Holly used to babysit, told us that the riddle of Holly's murder has become an indelible part of his life.
Well, first of all, I'm thankful that you called. I'm honored that I have the opportunity to speak with you. I really, on some level, I wanted to come to a conclusion, because I want to be able to pack it away and know that it's done. On another level, I don't, because it's something that I've always wanted to know what happened. And the question is whether the journey or the destination is more important. It's something my brother and I have talked about. And whatever the answer is, but you know, there's got to be an answer. I've spent since age 12 looking for it. Again, not every day, not the intrepid investigator, but you know, it's like carrying a weight with you that's always there. It nags every once in a while, but it's you understand it. I'd like to get to the end of it.
Since 1979, people have been waiting for the end of this story. They still want an answer to who killed Holly. And if authorities can get that answer, will it shed a light on Sean's death? Was he silenced because of what he knew or claimed to know? At one point in the investigation, there was hope that DNA might bring police closer to the end. It hasn't happened yet. But DNA science continues to evolve. Could there still be hope for this case through the physical evidence? Or will someone come forward with the clue that will finally close this case? If you have any information about the murder of Holly Brannigan, call the Bethlehem Police Tips Line at 610-691-6660.
Thanks for listening to APB Cold Case. Tell us about your cold case at apbcoldcase@spawngroup.com. APB Cold Case is an original Spawn Group production.